Well, one of the great parts about working in recovery is seeing former patients successfully move on. And I've had patients that have come up to me years later and shake my hand and say, you know, sometimes people are kicked out of treatment. And many of these folks move on to become mental health professionals themselves. And, of course, the field of psychology is vast. The need for competent practitioners is huge. If you're considering this rewarding career, I urge you to consider the California School of Professional Psychology at Alliant University. Now, I've known them for a long time at Alliant University. I've spoken at their past events. It was founded in 1969. It's boasts an alumni network of nearly 50,000 people worldwide. And Alliant has fostered many of today's mental health pioneers, authors, and advocates. CSPP at Alliant University hosts both on-ground and online programs in business psychology, marriage and family therapy, clinical counseling. They also offer APA-accredited doctoral programs in clinical psychology that can allow for specialization in child psychology, clinical forensic psychology, and integrated psychology. And the faculty is crazy. It's made up of leaders and historical figures like Abraham Maslow, Carl Rogers, Viktor Frankl, some of the true fathers of modern psychology. For more information, and I worked alongside of these students as well, by the way, in the clinical setting, as well as having lectured at the institution. So for more on the California School of Professional Psychology, CSPP, at Alliant, click the Alliant banner on our website or visit Alliant, Alliant.edu, Alliant.edu. All right, it is fall and your immune system is about to get tested, everybody. Not only does the changing weather mark the start of cold and flu season, it's also back to school time when kids become walking petri dishes. While catching something may be inevitable, there is no excuse for letting yourself get dehydrated in the process. So when you're wiped out with cold or flu, the first piece of advice always to drink plenty of fluids, but we seem to forget that. Now, once you've started feeling dehydrated, it's already too late for water or sports drinks. Rapid rehydration requires the proper balance of sodium, glucose, and water, and nothing gives this like Hydralyte. Hydralyte's formulation is based on established, proven science, and it is the simply best rehydration product I've found in this country. Hydralyte comes in great flavors, orange, berry, lemonade, and it's available in a pre-mixed drink, a powder, or what I prefer, those effervescence tablets. You just drop in a glass of water or a bottle of water, off you go. It's like your own portable IV, but you can do it enterally. Compared to sports drinks, Hydralyte delivers up to four times the electrolytes with 75% less sugar. Hydralyte solutions are appropriate for all ages, and each bottle or package includes easy-to-use, easy-to-follow instructions. You can find Hydralyte at Rite Aid or online at Amazon.com. And for a limited time, our listeners can save 30% on Hydralyte. Just click the banner on our site, drdrew.com. 30% off. Great deal. Do it. Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Wow, indeed, here we are. We're going to be joined by Russell Brand in just a minute. Everyone knows who Russell Brand is. He's got a new book. It is called Recovery from Our Addictions. And Russell Brand, there's the cover of his book. Let me get that on the camera. There we go. Bob is still there. There it is. Bob, you still with me? I don't hear him for some reason.
I got the
there. You are there. You are, buddy. So Bob's on Zoom. Welcome to the program. It's another episode of This Life. Bob, you want to start it like we always do?
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather everyone around. Get on the Facebook Live. Get the Wi-Fi pumped up, and it's another episode of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob Forrest.
Pump up the Wi-Fi. Pump up the Wi-Fi.
Pump up the Wi-Fi. Get the broadband going.
Right. I got a little bit of a cold, in case you can't tell. And before we start, I also want to thank our sponsors. We have Hydralyte, of course. Fluid replacement systems that I can't say enough about that. It can avoid IV therapies. You don't need those stupid IVs. Use the Hydralyte. And also Alliant University, the professional school of psychology. Russell apparently is studying for a master's in religion and global politics. Really very interesting. And I got a lot of stuff to talk to him about. Bob, he and I did a few minutes on the radio this afternoon, and I was surprised to hear talking to him that he did not know that 12-step was under assault. And that's something that you and I are dealing with all the time.
But I think like I was saying before we went on, I think it's not under attack anywhere else in the world but in America because of the rehab industry.
Yeah, I think it is the fact that the people really have a trouble with anything that makes any claim to any spiritual anything, and I really think 12-step has a PR problem. They need to take the spiritual element and leave that as part of the personal part of the process and not part of what it's thought of in terms of its primary purpose and primary function. And then people immediately go to, oh, it's religious and it's not, and there's no science and there's 20% success rate. Therefore, screw it. No good. What happened to you, Bob?
I fell down again. I don't think I got my thing set up. So my iPhone 7S is not set up so
7S,
good.
Nice.
But this subject fascinates me. The number one Google search for people with addiction is alternatives to 12 steps.
Right.
So, but I think that's only specifically an American thing, because I think American 12 steps has been so affected by the recovery industry.
I know is that it's free. It's free.
And that's what I always
How bad say. Can it be if it's
How about
free?
This? It's everywhere in America, on every corner.
Free.
And it's free.
Free. And it doesn't hurt and may be what you need. And Russell, I read Russell's book. It's very good, Bob. You know how it is usually when a celebrity or a recovering person writes a book? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It usually, at least, even if it's good, they always tend to go outside their lane and sort of start preaching and stuff and really sort of advocating for things that they almost like they've had psychiatric training and they have no business doing. He stays right in his zone. His thing is, I'm a self-centered prick a lot of the time, and this is what I have to do every day to stay sober. And that's it. And he goes through the steps in a very thorough one. And I can't imagine you would think it was anything other than exactly the way it should be presented.
Yeah. And that, you know, there's us late baby boomers, we're all, and Gen Xers are all doing it. The things we don't like about it, we just have the ability to set things aside. Millennials don't. Millennials are the things driving the AA kind of anti-AA movement in America. They're just not going. They're not interested. Hmm. They've always had somebody holding their hand, and nobody holds your hand in the 12 steps. You got somebody that's helping you, but not holding your hand.
Well, and to be fair, sometimes kicking your ass, and they may not like that so much.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Not holding your ass.
Yeah, I remember I was working with a guy in Colorado, and I was talking to a kid that had been sober like 10 years, and he said, or maybe 6 years. And he said he got sober because he called this one treatment center, and the guy got on the phone. It's sort of a public, you know, 12-step based thing. He got on the phone, and he goes, "You don't have a freaking prayer in hell of getting sober. You disgust me. Get out of here. Here's a number you can call, but I know you're not worth. I know you don't have it in you to call, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. But get out of my sight." The guy was so mad at him for saying that to him that he got sober out of resentment for that guy. And of course, he had referred him to somebody very good who's deep in the community and stuff. But it's that kind of, you know, as a physician, you can't do anything like that, right? Only other recovering people can do something like that. And they have a sense of when somebody needs it, right? I mean, you would know that.
Yeah, a sense of when, you know, Gloria Scott, the woman that helped me so much, she had just an attunement of when to say you're full of shit,
right,
and when to say, hey, it's going to be okay.
Right. That is really hard.
That's a lost art at this point.
Yeah, I mean, professionals, we aren't really trained to do that. I mean, I had to do it because I was working with you guys, and I kind of learned how to do that. But even, you know, I was sucked down the path all the time into gratifying patients. I mean, that's just sort of what we do. We're professional rescuers in a weird way. And for addicts, if you're working with addicts, that can go very bad.
So are we going to talk about gambling addiction and
sure.
its effect on the brain?
Well, hang on. I will in just a second, but he says freedom from our addictions on the cover of his book, and he has Instagram, caffeine, texting, shopping, social media, smoking, gambling, et cetera, work, Twitter, blah, blah, blah. So he's happy to talk about that. What do you want to – you've got it on your mind because of the shooter in Las Vegas, right?
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you that I think all of the listeners want to know, there's been many statements about benzodiazepines causing agitation and violence.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that. Is that true?
Well – it goes the other way, right? It causes sedation and lethargy, right? That's your sense of it?
That's how you do it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I have rarely seen people who get large doses intravenously for like a procedure that get agitated. I've seen that. I've never seen it from oral dosing. I've never seen it chronically. But
yeah, I've never seen it. And there was lots of claims out there that he was put on benzos in June or something, and that might have triggered this. Like,
I keep worrying there's a medical problem or medication that I mean, think about this.
Brain,
Yeah, it's a brain problem. Think about it this way. It seems to be a chronic compensated psychopath or sociopath, right?
Yeah.
Right. Dad's a psychopath. He inherits some of that genetics. He has a pretty traumatic childhood because of the dad. He sort of holds it together his whole life. Now, that guy, if you were to describe that guy on paper and say, and then one day he flipped, you would immediately, if you understood that profile, go, oh, well, he must have been 40, 42, 38, something like that. Because 30s and 40s is when those guys do that. They don't do it in their 60s. So What's weird about this is that something must have pushed. He remained compensated through the usual window when this happens, and something pushed him in his 60s. I bet he's been fantasizing about stuff like this since he was a teenager. That's what I bet. But he still held it together till all of a sudden something flipped him into action.
I've been using this as a reason why we all need therapy. Everybody that suffered trauma in childhood, everybody that's been abandoned, No matter how high a functioning you are, whether you're Harvey Weinstein or this nutcase or me or you, everybody needs therapy. And the fact that therapy is stigmatized in this nation is part of how we end up with things like this.
Right. And then 12-step gets thrown into that same bin. And, you know, it's just a reminder. I don't think enough is being made of the fact that we have been through an epidemic of childhood trauma. I think that's why there's so much aggression being acted out on social media. I think that's why there's just so many – all the horrible stories we're seeing is, to me, the result of adverse childhood experiences. How long have you heard me talk about pre-revolutionary France? 15 years? Yeah. Right? I kept saying, this feels like pre-revolutionary France. This is what happened there. And here we are, and things are unraveling.
The cake guy. So this is perfect. This is a perfect storm.
Well, how's that?
Because you have this – covet this strange thing in this country where there's all this anger towards the wealthy, but there's also all this envy towards the wealthy. And
I know. Riddle me this, Bob.
That's very much like France to me.
Oh, absolutely. Let's do sort of a thought experiment for a second. I'm going to try it on you. What if we could do something where everybody got raised up about 10%, but 10 people got infinity money as a result? Would that be okay? I mean, what do we care about those people with infinity money if everybody benefits in some substantial way? Or we all benefit 100%, but then somebody gets infinity.
10%, yeah.
No, let's say everybody benefits 1,000%. Let's do a different thought experiment. Everybody's goes up 1,000%, right? Everybody. Except in doing so, we make 5 people have infinity improvement. Do we care about those 5 people?
I think the society we have now would be hyper-focused on
those 5 people. See, that's the insanity to me. I want everyone to get better. I want the boat to rise. I want everyone to do great. I don't care about what some maniac's doing in Monaco. I don't care. Enjoy. He's not happy. Don't worry about everybody. But we don't. We'd rather be in envy. That's a more gratifying position, it seems.
It is a strange thing, isn't it? I don't remember it as a kid. Was it there?
No, and when you were a kid, if you saw Don Draper in the first class, your dad would go, "Hey, man, one day this could be you." And you'd go, "Hello, sir," and you'd tip your hat. Now you go, "That scumbag. That scumbag. Why does he get first class?" Right?
Yeah, maybe.
What do you mean, maybe?
No, I'm trying to think. I was raised that – people, it wasn't so much about money, it was about the person that they were, that I don't know how to explain it, but my dad didn't measure people by their wallets because everyone knew kind of had wallets.
Right, their stature and prestige.
He measured it by amiability, I can tell you that, whether you were a good guy, a solid guy that got along and liked to have fun and liked to laugh, and you were a serious guy.
And would you argue that prestige had more influence than money? You know, what you were doing, what you did that gave you prestige. So you offered something that was worthwhile to the society.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're so far off the track.
Also in a celebrity culture where celebrities got a free pass, George Murphy, Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan. They were like
Let's get a Brit in here to settle the score for us. He's coming on in. He's coming in. Russell, I will not shake your hand because I've got a cold. You do not want this thing. Trust me. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Doug.
He is sitting down. Bob Forrest is on the other end there on a Zoom.
Hello, Bob.
How are you?
Hey, man.
All right, mate. Hey.
You are doing a lot of running around, sir.
Yes, it's been a frenetic few days in your nation, I'll tell you that.
I know. How are the book sales?
I think it's going well.
Good. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So, Bob and I were talking about something that caught my attention when you were on the radio this afternoon, is you didn't seem to understand how much 12-step is being vilified in this country. And even your friend Joe Rogan, after you left, tweeted, oh, 12-step's BS. I don't know. Nonsense. It's not scientifically based. There's no evidence for it. And we have been apologists for it for decades because we've seen it work. We know how it works. Bob is a sober person and has been, you know, we've been treating people for a long time with great success. To me, the only conundrum in 12-step, and by the way, your book, which I'll hold the title up now with my notes on it again, your book does a great job of walking people through the steps and the experience of the steps, which I admire. The only thing about 12-step is that where it fails is when people don't want to do it. That's the only time it fails. When they do it, it works. It's very simple.
Yes, I would agree with that analysis. Now, of course, people encounter the 12 steps at different times in their lives, and there are people with all sorts of different challenges. There are people with very, very severe addiction and mental health issues who it's not just a simple matter of accepting there's a problem, coming to believe it could be better, accepting help, being willing to take inventory. We're talking about people that are severely ill. And I think, you know, with most medical conditions and mental health conditions, recidivism is an aspect. But what I feel is being addressed by the phenomena of addiction is a notion that is neglected even beyond this field.
Well Bob's going to love this. You mentioned it on the radio today. So Bob is of your similar mindset. Bob, here you go. You listen carefully.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Russell.
That people are living materialistic, individualistic lives, and that we have lost our access to spirit, that we're living in a consumerist, capitalist culture that tells us that all of our needs can be met through consuming.
And when you walked in, we were just talking about the manifestations of envy, that envy is sort of at least in this country, it's the present sort of just the general tone. It's like, those guys have it, F them, I'm going to get them and knock them down because I want those things you're just talking about right now.
Well, I can see some legitimacy in people feeling dissatisfied because we are living in a very unequal society, very unequal times, and the social contract has been breaking down, I would suggest, for a long, long time, possibly 50 years. And I don't know enough about political history to offer up too much of an articulate narrative, but it seems that in a way colonialism continued after the independence of America, merely in corporate form and
huge cultural forms, at least
cultural forms. Yeah. And it requires a repressed and oppressed population in order to be perpetuated. So I understand why people feel frustrated. I understand why people are angry.
We were saying, though, people are so messed up now, though, that even if we were to, as a thought experiment, we said, what if we could take the entire population and raise everyone's financial and well-being status 1,000%, but five people got infinity improvement? They still would be focusing on those five people and not be satisfied.
I think that possibly if any attempt to remedy an inner problem to do with people's state of consciousness and mental health through solely external means would fail.
Now, you're studying religion in global politics, don't
you? Yes.
Right? Explain what that is.
It's to see how the division between those categories, religion and politics, are in a sense arbitrary, that religion is used as a de facto term these days to stand in for irrational, and that politics is used to mean rational, and how religion can often mean to be used to determine otherness and to rationalize the sort of the powerful's violence against them.
It's a way to create an outgroup.
Yes, in a sense. And also that secularism is sourced from religious ideologies, that liberalism, for example, is a theology that has principles such as individualism and universalism, which are in themselves sourced from Kantian ideology, and those are forms of religious ideology. The idea of the universal, the idea of the individual, the idea of humanitarianism is sourced from religious ideology. So secularism cannot exist in opposition to religion because it is in itself a type of theology that simply replaces the idea of God with the idea of man.
So when I hear you talk about these things, I feel like you're describing a continuum from a explicit theological religious sort of religion, what do we say, a religious state,
yes,
like the Romans or the Greeks,
yes,
and whereby the philosophers start to take over and create a philosophical construct that we then apply in a political context. But you're saying that's all coming from religion ultimately. We just don't realize it.
Yes, and I think importantly, Dr. Drew, that power finds ways to mask itself and does what is required to mask itself. And if it means, oh, we're not a religious state anymore, this is this new thing called secularism, as long as the same people are ultimately powerful, then the order is can continue. Yeah,
but wow. Isn't it, the thing I'm always fascinated with is the caste system in India, which is trying to become a first world country. And Drew, I've tried to explain it to you. It's the craziest thing ever. It's so foreign to the way Western Europeans think. Russell, could you explain a little bit about the caste system in India?
And that has a religious sort of beginnings to it too, right?
I suppose it does.
Well, it's reincarnation. You move up the caste. But
it really helps out economically for the elite of India to control the wealth.
Well, Bob, I don't know enough about Hindu theology to speak lucidly, but I do know that Gandhi, when speaking about the caste system, said it was an abomination and that it was never intended to be hierarchical, just that there were different groups of people, different energy systems. But to your earlier point, Bob, I would think that there are African-American people in certain urban cities that would say to white men like us that there is a caste system and they are being penalized by it in this culture.
For sure, no doubt.
So I think we do have a caste system. I think we have a secular, democratic caste system.
We have
system.
A class system, that's for sure.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And no one's willing to have that conversation, right?
Yeah.
I think they do it in England, they kind of do. And when you do, they get very angry about it. Whenever I've talked to friends about class, they get very upset.
Yeah, class is very important in my country. Movement yeah. between class is very complex. I suppose, you know, it's not an exact replica, but
we won't talk about it. We won't discuss it yet. It just won't discuss
it. But Drew, we've done an interesting thing the last 30 years. We've said anybody who has a job is in the middle class, even though everybody doesn't feel like they're in the middle class. You know what I mean? If you have a job, you're middle class. It's a new
fantasy,
you know, disguise for things, like Russell's saying, for the people in control to say, oh, yeah, you have a new car. You know what I mean? So you're middle class.
But to each one of these conversations, we're having these very shorthanded, very complex topics we're trickling
into. How come Bob's allowed to do it on a sofa over there, really relaxed, and we all have to sit bolt upright in a studio?
I know. I don't think it's fair either, Bob. Bob was supposed to come here, but he decided...
Bob looks like he's at a Grateful Dead concert. We're trying our hardest to be professional broadcasters.
Right behind me, my hero Joe Strummer right there.
Oh, there he is, the great Joe Strummer.
But to some extent, the kinds of things you're talking about, which is the will to power, is really sort of underneath some of that, right? It sounds like something uniquely human, that humans have that. That's why their systems keep getting set up that way. Wherever you go, there seems to be a hierarchy. Wherever humans go, they set up hierarchies.
It does seem to be the case, doesn't it?
The question is, can we adjust that in such a way that it's still fair and still functions properly, right? I mean, you're not saying get rid of hierarchies, because humans just do that.
I wonder what evolution can mean. I suppose the thing I've been thinking about a lot lately is the way that centralized power seems to be corrupt, and that power should be as close as possible to the people affected by it.
Well, that was always the intent of this country.
Was it?
Oh, what?
I went off track.
We freaking went way off track. Well, read Alexis de Tocqueville, 1822.
I've heard of that name. What is he, Alexis de Tocqueville?
He was a Frenchman that came over here to study the new phenomenon of democracy, and he wrote a two-tome book called Democracy in America.
Right.
And he went all over the United States and interviewed everybody, Andrew Jackson, senators, everybody. And he concluded that the reason it worked... Forget whether it was good or bad. The reason it worked, and he was interested in egalitarianism because the French have always been that's been their thing. But he thought democracy was coming, whether the French wanted it or not, and he wanted to show how it worked in America. And he felt the reason it worked in America was, first of all, was British institutions, and secondly, it was the practice of democracy locally.
Yes,
that every little city, every little township, every little classroom had democratic elections, had leaders, had people that represented but felt responsible to represent their group. And that habit of democracy then got translated to a larger stage of representative government. We lost the representative government. We started becoming a direct democracy, and we centrally – and there was, you know, the – if you – You seen Hamilton yet, the play?
Actually, I haven't.
Okay. Hamilton.
You can't get tickets.
You know, we can work out for you. Alexander Hamilton was a big Federalist, and he wrote something called the Federalist Papers, which was an argument for having a strong central government. And if you're a slippery slope arguer, he started us on the slippery slope to a very centralized big government. So,
that was really clearly explained.
But we only really – that does not look like Alexander Hamilton, by the way. Oh, that's Alex de Tocqueville, yeah. But to be fair, our central governments really only got out of control. The federal governments really only got out of control during war. That's when we just exploded. And the rest of the time, the states were big and bloated and overdone too. But we have counties. That's why we have all these different levels of government. Okay, my wife, who's the producer, wants us to talk more about your book. So let's talk more about the book.
Thank you.
I really did enjoy the book. Talk to us about what the intent was in the book. And let me just, before you do, say I really had given up on England and its understanding of addiction. Let me tell you why. The Amy Winehouse movie was so disgusting to me to see the way she was treated by professionals that literally killed her, frankly. And there was one guy in that whole film. Did you see the documentary about her?
Yes.
One guy seemed to know what he was talking about. And I was like, oh my God, there's one guy over there that knows how to treat drug addicts. And the rest of them actively engaged in her demise. So I thought, it's just hopeless. But I read your book and I thought, oh, Russell really understands this. Somewhere there is recovery is alive and well in England. So what was your intent in writing the book?
My intention was to communicate these ideas clearly so that people suffering from addiction could understand that there is a solution, that if you have substance misuse issues, that abstinence should be your goal. But from my own experience as an addict, getting clean from crack and heroin and seeing how that behavior morphed and mutated to other behaviors that still felt like they were the demonstration of the same condition, i.e. around sex, around food, made me feel like these steps work for addiction itself, but they work around the behaviors. And of course, as a part of the process of doing the 12 steps, I took an inventory of my past, and I saw that my previous bulimia, my previous codependent relationships with my family members, for example, and my tendency to get into trouble, my tantrums, my self-harm, my rage, all could be understood through the lens of recovery. So what I think that the 12-step program is a delivery system from unconsciousness to consciousness. And what I believe, Doctor, is that we don't choose between working a program and not working a program. We choose between a conscious program and an unconscious program. And if you're not working a conscious one, you're working an unconscious one. You're working the program of your childhood, of your conditioning, of your culture. And for a lot of people, that has very, very negative consequences.
Bob?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I've gone through it. And Russell, I don't know how you came to this point, but, you know, they talk about the onion being peeled. Just year after year, you see the rage and you address that. And you see the codependency and address that. And gambling was my thing.
I know Bob was well into recovery, working for me. And just on Fridays to go to Santa Anita. No big deal. Just a friend. All of a sudden, we were all like, "Bob, what are you doing?"
We didn't work with Dr. Drew 3 hours early so I could beat traffic to go gamble, Russell.
We had
so
no idea.
All in it together.
You had the monkey back on your back, Bob. It leapt back on you when he was free. Right under the gaze of Dr. Drew.
I know,
what's wrong with you?
I know. How worthless am I as a professional?
That's like having corruption in the White House itself. You were unthinkable. Unthinkable.
Impossible yet.
You discover more and more that it's the same thing. And it's funny that you said childhood, because I think it's our coping strategies dealing with childhood that goes haywire. They just don't.
All right. Let me give Russell my full thing, and I think we're going to talk about this afternoon, right? Is this the intent of this evening, is to have more of a 12-step conversation?
I'm quite happy for you to moderate, in particularly now that I've been on your show. I feel very happy in your hands. In fact, I might have you look at a few other medical matters if you've got time.
Maybe backstage before we get out there.
Oh, yes, please.
Some of them are very embarrassing.
Feedback, Russell.
Hey, I've read your book, man. There's not much left.
There is.
But I want to let me Bob put a little finer point on what you said, and then I want to explain to Russell my genetic theory that you've heard before. So is that the way I think about this is that insufficiencies in childhood and or childhood trauma derail the usual development and emotion of an emotional regulatory system. It also limits the ability to connect, because connection becomes dangerous and untrustworthy and difficult. You sort of navigate it. You can't get in it. You can't stay there. And it is in the context of closeness with other people that we actually build the system of regulation. So for somebody that develops an addiction, usually the emotions before they develop the addiction are too prolonged, too intense, and too negative. And you can't regulate your way out of them the way your brain is designed to, because it's sort of not integrated yet. You stepped out of the system of contact that allows for that development because of trauma or abandonment or neglect or an addicted parent or whether you said codependency, that's focusing on the other person, make sure they're okay, your mom or whoever, as opposed to her just being present, giving you what you need so you can build that system. So now you're a young adult or an adolescent and you're looking for a solution to that. Well, guess what works? Drugs and alcohol. All right. Then you trigger a second problem. Now you trigger this thing we call addiction. But where did that come from? Well, I, Bob, you've heard me say this before. You want to frame this business about how I think addicts are more evolved?
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say when he first discussed it. So abstinence can lead to thriving and being a human being that can help your community, that can be of service to the world and your children. And all the other models can't do that. They can't do that, right? So I just say abstinence is the best. Nowadays, there's so many people addicted to drugs in America. Drew and I have been discussing, is survival just the best for a lot of these people?
Right. That seems to be where our government wants us just to get them alive. We're interested in getting people to be like you, to thrive and to find meaning in life. And the world, the medical community particularly, is interested. That's too dangerous.
Yes.
They might die.
I agree with your initial diagnosis on a personal level. That resonated with my personal early circumstances. I don't have a medical worldview. That's not my toolkit for understanding reality. It's more philosophical, emotional, and spiritual. But certainly your language resonated with me in the description.
Yeah, it's the same. It's just different language. Yeah, it's different language. But let me tell you the genetic part. You'll like this too. Which is that you have to ask the question, if this gene is so destructive and causes all this horrible stuff, why has it been so consistent in the human genome throughout human history? So to answer that, it has to be that it has some genetic advantage, some survival advantage. Well, the way we look at those kinds of things, we'll take isolated populations and stress them and see what happens. Well, what happened in Scotland? And what happened to North American Indians? And what happened in Eastern Central Europe when they were stressed genocidally? When you, like Scotland being the best example that I know of, when you genocidally, multi-generationally stress a population, this gene just emerges like crazy. Not that they're using drugs or alcohol when the gene emerges. It's just this gene makes people better survivors in extreme adversity. Mm. And now if you look at addicts, they make great race car drivers and shortstops and extreme athletes, thrill seekers. You talked about the adrenaline stuff in your book.
Gestured at me.
Yeah, well, you talk about it in the book. And I'm saying that is not an advantage when we're sitting in a room with curtains and a microphone. But if a bunch of Huns came over the hill, I would turn and run and get a spear in the back. You would keep your wits about you because you're sort of turned on by the extreme situation.
I am turned on by these Huns. Hello, guys. You barbarians at the gates, come to sack out treasures.
We're going to have to figure out, knowing that you're going to run and get stabbed in the back, how to save you too, Drew.
Well, yeah, no, that's your codependency. That's because you grew up with an addict parent. That's different. That's a different problem.
I like the idea. I think that, yeah, that's...
There's something to that, right?
Makes great sense. Certainly, it's consistent. Genocidal stress on a population.
Multiple generations.
I like that very much. Of course, though, from my philosophical perspective, the yearning that initially expresses in chemical dependency or codependency or eating disorders can be ameliorated and to a degree resolved or at least abetted by the introduction of a spiritual program.
Okay. No.
So for me, this is talking about consciousness and connection and how do we survive in a culture that doesn't give us spiritual solutions because it's predicated overly on material circumstances, consumerism and materialism. So I like the analysis, but I'm a solution-based person.
Let's go into this because neither Bob nor I would disagree with you.
Good.
And but what
especially with these Huns at the gate.
My, No, but my point would be that's why a primary purpose is to stay sober and to help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. Because who fucking else on earth could do that job but us?
Oh yeah, because you get it, you get it. No one else gets it. But that's one spiritual program. But let's talk about spirituality because I think that's where this country gets bogged down.
Mm.
We want to have our own notion of it. We want to each have our own sense of it. Now, is that okay?
I think it is. I think, why not have your own notion of spirituality? Right. I mean, how could it possibly be otherwise? If all of us had been schooled in the same Mormon village and had downloaded the same spiritual data, what I imagined in my consciousness as the omnipotent force behind material reality would perhaps be different from your imagined concept, even if we had the same scriptural, textual experience. So,
but history would say that's not a bad way to go. Right, you're saying modern history.
Individual conceptions of a higher power.
No, you're saying modern history has been when we really fell out of bed. And throughout much of human history, we were sort of fed our spirituality. You sort of framed it, at least. And it seemed to be better.
We did it, Drew. There was nothing else but it. In my life, Catholicism was taught at birth.
Mm.
And that's just the way that
is. I would say Russell's not in that school.
No, I'm not. No, I'm thinking that these are. I would say that these are institutions of power. Whilst obviously Catholicism has carried some powerful and beautiful messages, as well as the demonstrably bad things.
But I'm not saying I'm a Catholic. I'm saying I went to DLF about 12, 14 years ago. Right? I know that you share this thing, and it's a magical place to go and a magical daily solution to things. But in my core, that Catholicism, that monotheism, I don't know how it gets out of you. You know what I'm saying? I don't know how you switch from monotheism
to... The Huns will take care of it. Don't you worry.
But Russell, could you help me with that? Because, you know, I've been to every religion through this 22 years, right? I was going to convert to Judaism. And I told the rabbi, you know, I feel like God, like Jesus is watching me and I'm mad at me that I'm meeting with you people.
Well, I would say that that's a manifestation of another aspect of your problem as opposed to sort of a Christian doctrine.
And I hope you said you people.
Yeah, that could have been a hot button.
But you know what I'm saying?
At least you chosen people. At least that. At least you could add that in there.
5 and 7 years old. I don't know how it shapes. I'm 56 now. It's still there. I'm pretty much agnostic.
William Blake says, Bob William Blake, the English poet and great inspiration for the rock and roll movement, by which we're all inspired, says that each artist must create his own religion. In a sense, meaning we have to find our own path to the sort of divine within us. And by the divine, I mean the essential truth. And by essential truth, I mean an aspect of my consciousness which is not cognizant static. There is my thinking mind. I am Russell. I did this. I'm on Dr. Drew's radio show. But behind that, there is the experiencer of the thoughts and the feelings. Now, most religious traditions have some methodology to guide you towards this state of consciousness. In our literature, the 12-step literature, it says, be quick to see where religious people are right. Implicit in that is the idea that there are many obvious ways where religious people are wrong, but I would argue, particularly having now done a degree in religion in global politics, that when we talk about religion from this perspective, we are talking about power systems. We're not talking about access to the divine. We're not talking about journeys into consciousness. So for me, I look at what is constant across religious faiths, what is perennially present, like when Dr. Drew was talking about different cultures producing hierarchies. Most cultures produce some form of divinity, some form of worship. Yep. And the way that the culture mutates and the inflections that these faiths require is usually about the maintenance of power systems. So if we find our own way to God, using what we like about Catholicism, what we like about Islam, what we like about New Age hippy-dippy stuff, as long as it works for us and it leads you to leading a moral, ethical, useful life, where you're connected to yourself, to the love in yourself, and you're connected to one another, I feel like we've accessed a solution. And it's difficult to do that, I think, in a culture that constantly makes you feel frightened and constantly makes you feel full of desire.
All right. So there's a lot packed into those last statements. Let me parse it out a little bit. Because you use words we've not been using before, and I think they're critical to this conversation, which is love, connection, one another, right? Love, connection, other.
Yes. Right,
those are three key words in your system. And I think anyone that that's probably what Jesus was talking about, right?
We are similar.
But you're saying, He may have been a little less grandiose, but anyway.
The way to the kingdom of heaven is through me. Throw away all your stuff and follow me.
But
forgive them, Father. They know not what they do.
But I believe that that's probably what he and others were talking about. And what you're saying is that we fucked it all up, right? Mm-hmm. We messed it all up, right? And you're trying to get us back to the basics again. Yes? Would that be just a simple way of saying that?
Yeah, that's a really simple way of saying it.
Okay, very simple. Do you know Martin Buber? Do you study his stuff?
No.
Okay, Martin Buber is a famous philosopher that felt that spirituality existed in what you and I create in this thing we call a relationship. I, thou, and this. And that's where love and magic and spiritual, and that's where it all really emanates from. And I think he was kind of there's, and Hegel even started with that too, believe it or not. Hegel had when he started where the self came from, it's deeply embedded in his early stuff, but he started from the same place that the self emerges from the other. It's really all about the other. And in this country, we feel like we have a right to happiness, right? The pursuit of happiness. And I had a French teacher once who told me that was the stupidest thing the Americans ever, like, how could you give somebody a right to happiness? It's like, to her, it was offensive that you would call somebody a right to happiness. But we don't even know what we're talking about anymore by happiness. We don't know. I mean, because there's probably two different kinds of happiness, right?
Is it the absence of suffering? I don't know.
Well, you have to have an absence of suffering first, but that's still not happiness.
But whilst that aspect of the constitution becomes increasingly irrelevant with the passage of time, the pursuit of happiness, I would say, and this is a kind of a first century Christian idea that C.S. Lewis writes about very lucidly, that perhaps the presence of happiness, along with the presence of other moral impulses, is in the indication of a certain rightness, i.e., I talk about this in the book, that, look, if I'm not feeling happy, something is wrong.
What do you mean by happy? That's what I want to get at.
Connected and present.
Okay.
Like, I'm not talking country, about pleasure. I'm not talking about McDonald's and fellatio.
That's right.
Pleasure is not, that's pleasure right. is
pleasure,
irrelevant.
You got that from heroin.
Delightful stuff. Yeah, very relaxing.
Cocaine gives you pleasure, right?
I mean, that's uplifting, upbeat, nice.
Bob, pleasure, heroin. That was good for you, right?
He's still here, isn't he?
Experience it now from OxyContin.
And buprenorphine, too, unfortunately, but yes.
If we go back to that screen and Bob's like trying to dodge traffic by leaving early, I'm going to panic. Bob, I'd like to see Bob
where
I can
see
him.
We want to know. Yeah, there he is.
I'm becoming very attached to Bob.
He's under me. There he is.
Oh, thank God. There he is.
He's still.
I think happiness, I just replaced it with wholeness.
There's
a point in a day or in a couple of days period of time where I feel right-sized and whole.
He just said rightness. That's what Russell said. I think he's right. And in this country, when you say happiness, they think pleasure. They think euphoria. Not pleasure, the euphoria.
You can sell people pleasure. You can't sell people happiness. I think that the problem is the economic systems that govern our way of life. Yeah. We're seen as individuals. We're seen as consumers. When De Boer talks about in The Spectacle, when you're at work, you're a worker. When you're home, you're a consumer, looking at a screen, being marketed at. And I think we're continually manipulated to states which require action, e.g. fear requires action, desire requires action. Wholeness, as Bob said there, a sense of rectitude and connection means I am complete. I also agree, Dr. Drew, with what you said there about relationships. Someone said to me recently, we don't exist in isolation. We exist in dialectic. Yeah. Who are we without one another in an aluminium capsule in space?
I think consciousness comes from others. I'm of that theory. For instance, if you got lost in the woods at 3 months of age and emerged at 15, do you think you'd have consciousness in the way that we think of consciousness?
Possibly not.
You just act. You'd just be hungry and shitting and whatever, and you'd be.
Well, there was that dog girl, wasn't there? You know that.
Well,
girl.
I don't know if that really happened.
She didn't.
But there was a French. I don't know why I keep going back to France 10 times. There was a wolf boy or something that came out of the woods in some part of France, and they studied him, but they didn't really do a good job. It was in the 19th century, but the point is that for sure yourself would not exist if you didn't have the others.
It's relational, and objectivity and subjectivity, I suppose, are sort of the great philosophical territories that are very, very difficult to designate and understand, I suppose.
Well, they've certainly screwed that all up, right? The philosophers. I mean, you've referenced several so far, and it sounds like your worldview is sort of Kantian. Is that right?
No. Yeah. What, like, what I feel actually, no.
Or what, what's went, gone wrong with the world is Kantian, let's put it that way.
Yes, yeah, yes. Yeah, like, I think it's our inability to incorporate the irrational, that we have a materialistic and rationalistic worldview, and that posits us in the position where you're an individual living in your body, you live for 100 years max, so pack in the fellatio and the ice cream because there's nothing coming after.
Wait, I got to write that down. Pack in the fellatio and the ice cream. Hold on, I got it. That's keys to live by. Bob, pack it in.
I feel like I'm influenced, like the stuff that I was reading a lot of when I wrote that book, Joseph Campbell, your great American academic, and Carl Jung. And I'm interested in perennialism and archetypes, things that occur consistently through different religious faiths. And I'm interested in the oppression of the female in our culture, both in terms of women, but also the feminine within the male, that we are unable to connect fluidly to nature. I'm interested in the extraction of emotion from political discourse, the way that people can't talk about love and connection, that we only talk about checks, measures and balances, while forgetting that the economy itself is a kind of fiction. There is no free market. There is no God that we have to serve or pump funds into to keep alive when it fails in 2008. That our emotions and our connections to one another are what's real in our own lives. And if we have systems that govern us and ignore those facts, then we have systems that are abstract to our experience of being human.
Yeah, and getting people to connect again to that experience, as those are both your words, and I agree with them. It's hard.
I find it's the reason why the 12-step community is so needed now, is that there used to be community. When I grew up, we knew everybody in our neighborhood. My dad was part of a lot of different groups. I played baseball. It was really a town. And now there's no towns. It's all just phones dictating, scheduling.
Well, we're all sort of electronic. Our town hall is this stupid thing.
And the thing is that the 12-step world is one place where you can't have your phone. You sit in there for an hour and a half. You listen to things you agree with, things you don't agree with. People that are narcissists like me need to shut up and listen for 99% of the time. People that are introverted and withdrawn and kind of don't feel comfortable sharing with other people are forced to talk for a minute or two. It is the ultimate democracy, and I feel like it's being perverted. But and
by
that's
what?
Another conversation for another time.
What is that? Well, I don't know. Usually I know where you're going. I don't know where you're going.
The rehab industry distorted the 12-step community in Southern California.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was in England a few years ago. I went to some 12-step meetings. Didn't seem like that was affected by the recovery revolution industry. Seemed same old brick church, bunch of old guys, same as when I was there 20, 30 years ago. But here in America, it's become psychobabbly, what Russell suggested, hippy-dippy, new age, make up your own religion type stuff. And I think the greatest thing about it is it's free and it's everywhere.
Well, let's go back to solution, because we're running a little short on time. Because you got to do Bill Maher, I think, right?
Is that yes, I'm going to Bill Maher after here. That's going to be interesting, is it?
He's very smart. You know Bill?
I've never met Bill Maher before.
Oh, no, he's great. He's great. He's very,
he's a great man.
Very smart. Oh, very smart. But I'm not sure. Stuck in his ways. Let's put it that. I'm not sure he's open to new ideas. But he's very smart. He listens very carefully. So.
Oh, brilliant.
Selling happiness. I really think that's where the rubber's hitting the road here. That you see the reason we have a distorted view of happiness, because that's something that can be sold. So if commercialism is the issue, what's the solution?
I suppose to unpick the commodification of everything. Like what?
How?
We've
perfected that.
Perhaps to build communities on a different basis, and I believe that possibly that's through the development of different, smaller institutions, but that's a sort of on a more social level. On a personal level, I feel what I have to do is that one of the consequences of living in a capitalist consumer society, which has definitely delivered many, many brilliant things, is that I grew up and, if I'm not careful, continue to commodify my relationships, to look at people as in terms of what their value is to me. If that person can help me.
Well, that's anti-Kantian.
So, yeah, it's not a cool way to treat people. No. I don't know what Kant would have thought, but I mean, there's a word that sounds like it that describes the situation very accurately.
I think he would have used. He might not have used that word, but you and I know what you're talking about.
So
we just changed one of the vowels.
That's all. It's a simple vowel, and you're in a lot of trouble in my country, at least.
Oh, so, here they don't like that word at all.
I'm very careful with language these days.
It's not like Australia where they toss it around all over the place.
Oh no, it's a term of endearment to the Australians.
It's true. It's true.
They say it when they kiss
you.
Jim
Jeffries calls me that all the time. I think he likes me.
No, yeah, so. Jim. That would be a sign of great respect from Jim Jeffries. He must look at you as a kind of father figure.
Yeah, well, friend.
So, my feeling is that it's odd, actually, because a lot of what I'm saying is about decrying individualism. But in a sense, the genie's out of the bottle with individualism. We regard ourselves, as Bob was saying there, as individuals now, not as towns, not as communities, not as collectives, but as individuals. Even our idea of our national identity has become quite perverted and strange, at least in my country, and I sense that's possibly happening here.
Yeah.
Also, but in the level of the individual is one realm where we have some authority over change, and that's again why I think the steps are important beyond recovery from obvious forms of addiction. Firstly, for me, is a decision to live life differently, but that ultimately leads to being of service, observing that space between us that you mentioned. Was it Boober?
But what I would Boober. Say is,
I believe he's Yogi Bear's little friend, very bright guy, smarter than the average bear, certainly, and he came up with a theory.
Boo-boo, not to be confused with Baba Booey, but there's a Aristotle had a term called eudaimonia, right?
Oh, yeah.
Remember reading about that?
No, I don't know what that means.
Okay, eudaimonia was translated forever in this country as happiness, but it's been recently reconsidered as flourishing.
Probably that's beautiful.
Because happiness is different. So we're beginning to think, finally, at least some people are going to think that there's hedonic happiness, pleasure, and eudaimonic happiness, which at its core is about service.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. Oh, I really like that very much, because that's certainly my personal experience. Not that I don't return like a migrating, greedy little bird.
To your hedonic happiness.
My little nest of hedonism. That's where my mind likes to reside, and I'm sure there is a neurological basis for that. Patterns, traps.
Some of it is that, we've talked about your early childhood development and your habits, and that's part of that. I think genetically, alcoholic addicts are particularly into hedonia. They are very rewarded by it. Let's put it that way.
But what was that second one, the Aristotelian thing?
We'll talk about it tonight. I'll bring it up tonight on the stage.
I want to learn that word.
Eudaimonia. E-U-D. Yeah, he had a whole theory of you. I'll explain it to you. He felt there's E-U-D-A-I-M-O-N-I-A. He felt that, but you like this too. He felt that this is in the ethics, the Nicomachean ethics. He felt that to achieve eudaimonic happiness, you needed techne, a certain amount of skill. You needed phronesis, a certain amount of wisdom. And he had a couple of things I can't remember. But
it's good that you know that much Greek.
But the point is, you needed to have certain amount of, you need to put some invest training into being able to have something really that you could give.
Yes.
Like you went and got a religion degree and now you're giving it back. That's good. That feels different than it did probably before you got your degree, right?
I'm still in the middle of the degree.
Well, you know
I've
what you're talking
about. I owe them a lot of homework.
Tell us about that. Where is it? What's it like?
It's a university called SOAS, and it's a bit like a sort of a bad sort of mid-80s John Hughes movie where a 40-year-old celebrity goes to college and has to basically keep his eyes down in the corridor to stop himself looking at the undergrads because he's now married and got a baby. It's like going back to school. When I was at school, I was fat and I was insecure and felt all
you
worthless.
You got to practice the steps when you're walking down the hall.
Very, very deliberately. I watch where I stand, man. When I was a kid, it's like some odd dream where it's like, oh, one day you will go back to school and everyone will be looking at you and the guys will want to be your friends and the women will be looking at you. Oh, by the way, you'll be married and you'll have a baby.
Oh, thank you. Torture. So, but how many years into what? Into what program?
I'm 1 year.
1 year into a
religion in
which
an
is
MA.
A three-year program? Religion. Two-year program?
That's right, because I'm doing it part-time because I only go there 1 day a week.
So it's a three-year program.
Stand-up comedian.
And is it the kind of thing where you're tutored kind of thing, like at Oxford or something?
Yeah, I guess it is. There's a tutor, Sean Hawthorne, and then there's a class of like 20-year-olds from all over the world, because this place, SOAS, is real international community. So there's all kids. It looks like that parliament in Star Wars. Everyone's a different color. These kids are so bright and brilliant. It's like unbelievable how clever 20-year-olds are.
Annoying, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. If we're not putting something in the water, we need to start.
I don't want to get into a whole other topic.
Breastfeeding in the baby. How old's the baby?
My baby, she's 11 months old, my little Mabel, my daughter. Goodness. She's here with me, her and her mum.
That really does it.
Yeah, that's blown my little mind. That smashed me right in the nuts of my narcissism, Bob.
It really does. I got two little ones. It's crazy.
It changes everything, isn't it? Because now we actually are not the terminus of our own requirements. That little baby is. I'm just the guy that holds the screen that the Teletubbies are on.
Yep, we're not. We are not number one anymore.
No way. I don't even know if I'm number three. I don't know where I am in the numerical system. There's probably not a symbol for me.
Well, that by the way, to be fair, that's a form of service that we've lost track of a little bit too, which is serving our families and our responsibilities and our basic obligations. I'm not saying you guys have, but I'm saying that globally we have.
I certainly wouldn't have been in a position without this program to have been a member of a family. And I kind of, like, without wishing to be overly reductive, I feel like the more that we observe anthropologically perhaps how we would have lived before the emergence of certain technologies and systems, that we're closer to happiness. I don't mean...
Wait, say that again.
Well, possibly, I think the closer we live to the systems of our origin, the happier we are, i.e. if we live in communities of around 70 people, we can manage that. If you eat a varied diet that's determined by the climate of the place that you're in while you're in it, that's probably a good thing for you.
Right. So if we stayed within the confines of the environment in which we evolved,
somewhat. I'm not saying, you know, without medicine or technology.
Right. Philosophy's still good. Medicine's still good.
But it's in a way, it's just the system that has delivered those things. Yeah, the Teletubbies, I don't want to go back on that. We need them, especially on car journeys, which I also need.
The truth of it.
I'm telling you.
No, Russell, he had three kids at the same time. Did you have televisions in the car, Drew?
We eventually did, but we did not have iPads and phones and things like that. We eventually, by the time they were like about 8 or something, we had little screens that we could play Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind.
Yeah. long takes. Whatever would keep their attention for
a long time. What did parents do without cars TVs in the cars?
I mean, it's hell, isn't it, to even imagine such a time.
They got down on their all fours and they looked their babies in the eyes and they spent time with them, Bob. I know that's unthinkable, but that's what they're
supposed to face them away from you in this fucking modern politically correct nonsense.
What? Who said that?
Well, Bob, you made that one up.
I hope you made that one up. That's insane.
The car seat is supposed to face backwards.
Oh,
you can't,
the car seat.
Oh, right, I thought it was a parenting technique.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
And the shout at the back of my daughter's head.
All right, we're
going to
wrap things up. Poor Russell has got to go to do Bill Maher, and then he's got to meet me for a show at the Moss Theater later, for those of you that are listening.
There are 10 tickets left.
10 tickets left for those of you at Facebook and YouTube, or listening on Pod, whatever it is. It's tonight. This is Thursday, October 6th. Friday, October 6th. That's tonight? Yeah. And if you don't get the great opportunity to go see Russell tonight, go buy his book, Recovery, Freedom from Our Addictions. I was telling Bob, I didn't expect to like it. So congratulations. Because usually when recovering people write books about recovery, they get outside of their lane a little bit. You stay right in your lane. And you know what you're talking about.
Thank you.
And it's very clear and I would recommend it to people in recovery, contemplating recovery, struggling with recovery. It's a nice experiential how-to. I kid you not, and I don't do that lightly.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's a good job, and hopefully it will help a lot of people. And Bob, thank you as always, buddy. I'm sorry that you were put out by us today. You actually leaned forward from the couch.
Rehab.
Bob's like a Jim Henson creation.
You're a muppet.
It's like a puppet. Get him in here. I don't like him being over there. He's not safe. Something's going to happen to Bob.
I'll get you guys together eventually.
Bring him tonight. I'm worried.
Bob, we're not going to do recovery. We're not going to bust the chops of recovery tonight. You and I have done that enough over the many podcasts. Let's see. Give all your stuff, Russell. It's russellbrand.com.
Yeah, check me at russellbrand.com. I'm on tour in the UK as a comedian. If you want the book Recovery, get it off Amazon, because that seems to have a big impact on my life for some reason.
russellbrand.com/trues, T-R-E-W-S. Susan found those, loved those. We Are Recovery Radio on Zone 1 Radio. Is that you too?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Some recovering addicts set up a radio station. I've been supporting that.
Okay, that's very good. And get the book. Documentary. What's this?
I did a couple of documentaries with the BBC.
Oh, I saw one where you were testifying in front of the Parliament or something. Yeah,
yeah, that was interesting. I wore a strange outfit. Did you notice that?
I didn't notice that.
Well, you should have done. The Undertaker from WWF.
I felt like you knew what you were talking about, and they weren't getting it. I felt like they weren't getting it.
That's
generally the way I feel about talking to people in government and big bureaucratic systems.
They're on one frequency, and it's not the one we need.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you all for listening. Thank you all for the the Hydrolite and the Alliance. Check them out. Check out DrDrew.com. Check out the other family of podcasts we have out there. Producer Susan, everything else I need to. All right. We'll see you all next time.
Well, great job. What a great show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Remember, you can find all these podcasts at DrDrew.com. The Dr. Drew podcast, the This Life podcast, and the Adam and Drew podcast, which is available 5 days a week. Find them all on iTunes and rate us 5 stars. Subscribe and get it first. And if you're really happy, click on the Amazon banner at drdrew.com to help support the show. We'll thank you for it. If you join the email list via drdrew.com/contact, we'll send you a weekly infusion newsletter with Dr. Drew's news. We're so grateful when you get in touch. We read all your emails and we'll bring you the subject matter you want to hear about.
You live.